This is Just Talking It Up with Ross and Janet.
Thank you for joining us at Just Talking It Up. I'm Janet. I'm here with my buddy Crash, and we are going to continue our conversation with Mr. Erskine, who is just a fascinating man, and I thank him again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mr. Erskine. Carl Erskine, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the 51 season, just as a little background for our listeners. You guys had a 12-game lead about midseason. You'd just beaten the Giants three in a row, and then things kind of turned around. And by the end of the season, I think you all had to win. The Dodgers had to win their last game against the Phillies to even be tied with the Giants, who had come on strong, which you did. And that turned into a three-game playoff between the Giants and the Dodgers. And then, of course, the third game came around. So maybe you could lead us up to that point. Then I'd like to ask you a little bit about that ninth inning of the third game.
You know, baseball is so different than a lot of sports. You cannot get a lead in baseball and stall. You have to get 27 outs in a nine-inning game. We had a 13.5 game lead in August. And this is one of the great teams. Now, I'm telling you, this team on paper, you look at the stats of the various team members. But the Giants caught fire, and we learned later they used a telescope, and they were cheating a little bit. But they still won a tremendous number of games down the stretch. And we played just mediocre down the stretch. And so they did tie us. And in the National League in those days, there were no regular playoffs. But if you tied, and the National League had a 2 out of 3 series to determine the pennant winner. The American League in those days had a one-game sudden death for the whole pennant. But so, yeah, you're down to the third game. They won the first one. We won the second one. And we're leading 4-2 in the ninth inning of the third game, which would be the pennant game. And Newcomb's pitching. And we've all pitched with 2 days' rest down the stretch. So the whole staff was a little weary. And so when Newcomb got the ninth inning, he got a run in, a couple men on, and the score was 4-2. They called the bullpen, and Ralph Reich and I were warming up. And the conversation on the bullpen end, I could hear. I couldn't hear addressing the manager what he asked, but he must have said, "Are they ready?" Sukaforth, the coach, said, "They're both ready." He must have said, "Who's throwing the best," or whatever, "who has the best stuff?" And Sugi said, "Well, they're both throwing okay. Erskine got that overhand curve. He's been bouncing his curve some, warming up. He said, let me have Branca." So Branca came in, and the first pitch, a strike to Thompson. Second pitch, crowded him with a fastball, but he fought it off and hit it in the lower deck of the polo grounds, which was only, it was less than 300 feet. But it was a hard hit, sinking line drive. And that was a 3-run homer. That was a shot heard around the world. We lost a pennant. Bitter loss. And our fans, we felt so bad for our Brooklyn fans. But I sort of capped the story off by saying, when people ask me, "Carl, you pitched 12 seasons of the big league. What was your best pitch?" And I say, "I think it was a curveball I bounced in the bullpen."
So you didn't have to go into that situation. Yeah.
Well, you know, I kind of jest about it, but history plays out if you give it time. Ralph Branca, who was the GOAT of that incident, and Thompson was a hero with the Giants, and that's one of the most remarkable finishes ever in baseball history. And then to finish it with a walk-off home run was just unbelievable. You couldn't write a script make it believable. But in the end, it's interesting. Writer for the I think it was the New York, one of the New York papers, wrote an article about the exposure of a telescope in center field that the Giants used and called the pitches by sending it was a wired up deal to the bullpen, and they sent a buzzer and then a signal from the bullpen with a towel, which you could see easy from the plate, a fastball or a breaking pitch. So they called the pitches. It actually cheated down the stretch. But at the end, and Branca took all the heat and all the indignity. He's got hate mail galore. And Thompson just bathed in the heroes. But Josh Prager of the Wall Street Journal wrote the article, and he wrote a book, actually, about it. And in the end, he says an interesting thing, very poetic. He said, in the end, Thompson, who reveled in this and would never admit that he took the pitches, he was the hero. But in the end, Branca, of course, took all the heat. In the end, Branca and Thompson were in reverse roles. Thompson was the dodger. He dodged the truth. And Branca was the giant, but in dignity, he handled defeat in such a way he never blamed anybody, even the cheaters. I thought that was an interesting way to cap it. And Branca, of course, is a well-respected individual to this day, and, of course, tied in history to that famous pitch.
Yeah. You know, there was a book written, and they tried to get Thompson to say that he knew what pitch was coming because of what was in center field, but he wouldn't actually say that. So, yeah, but that was the inference.
He always said, I could have taken it if I wanted it. Yeah, we were getting the pitches. No, they never would admit it. Now, Willie Mays, I used to run into Willie at baseball functions after our days were over, playing days. And Willie would kid me. He said, hey, Carl, you know we got all your signs. We got all your signs, buddy. And I thought he meant he was picking up something from me on the mound, that I was giving away my pitches some way. But no, it later came out that they actually had the telescope. Now, in fact, there is no rule or law against stealing signs with a telescope. There are actually no regulation in baseball, and they've never written one since. Now, we know sign stealing is part of the game. That's part of the game.
Yeah, stealing signs is, absolutely.
But that to rig up a buzzer system, the commissioner at that time was Ford Frick, and he said later, if he'd have known that factually, he would have forfeited the games.
Hmm.
But it was well past the time when some of the Giants came forward and admitted that and explained how they did it. But anyway, that's a little fascinating part of history. But Branca, still living, he's 87 now, you know, almost the same age. And he is handled with dignity this really tough thing to be pointed at to the guy that threw the pitch that Thompson hit for the big home run.
You know, he's...
In the end, he turned out to be recognized as a real hero in the way he handled it.
Yeah. His son is a big baseball card collector. I have a fairly good collection myself, but his son has probably the second largest and best baseball collection in the country. It probably has a lot of his father's stuff. Let me ask you one other thing about the 51 game. I think Russ Hodges is the one who made the call on that, on the Thompson home run. But right. The story is that Ernie Harwell, who was announcing the game that day, had to go to the bathroom, and so he turned it over to Russ Hodges for that last half of the inning. As a matter of fact, Harwell's son lived in South Atlanta, and I met him one day, and he told me that was the case. So that's interesting.
I've heard that Russ Hodges tape repeated over and over and over. It always spoils my day when I hear it. But
you know, that was made by somebody in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
who
right.
Recorded
from a
that.
Fan. They got that from a fan, I do believe.
Exactly, over the radio. It was not something right. Recorded at the station in any way.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, that was such a shock for us to get beat there at the end of that season. But anyway, that's why they sell tickets to these games, you know.
Absolutely.
On paper, it looks one way, but you got to go play it. So.
You know, you can remember a lot of things. I remember where I was when Kennedy got shot, when Martin Luther King got shot, and when the shot heard around the world was hit. I remember exactly where I was standing when that happened. So one of the big things in baseball, if not in the last 100 years. Tell us a little bit about the 53 season. You had one no-hitter that year. Were both of them in 53 or?
No, I had one. Actually, I had a Cub no-hitter in 52 and a Giant no-hitter was 56.
Okay,
now,
all right.
And 53 was my best one-loss record, but the new no-hitters came in a couple other years.
You and I talked about the other day when we spoke Cincinnati, and both of us had a great memory of the Cincinnati Union Station. I was from Knoxville, Tennessee, and so I would ride the train to Cincinnati, and walk about 3 miles to old Crosley Field, see a game, and then walk back and take the train that night back to my hometown. And that was a beautiful old station there, Union Station. And they had some murals that you and I talked about that they have since moved to the airport in Cincinnati. But that was a great old park.
Yeah, right. Well, it was strange. That was train travel was it in those days. And when we play a doubleheader in Cincinnati, trains would come in from Birmingham to Atlanta, a lot of southern cities, and they were almost all black fans that came.
Right.
And just swarmed the ballpark. Now, another thing that people don't realize, in the late 40s, early 50s, Cincinnati and St. Louis segregated the crowds. And black fans sat only in either the Sun Deck or in St. Louis, the pavilion. And the white fans sat in the regular stand. Now, you can't imagine that either in America. But that was a time when this huge cultural change was taking place. And what Jackie did was so historic, looking back. He was out there by himself with Mr. Rickey's coaching and encouragement behind him. 10 years, a whole decade, before Martin Luther King came on the scene with his with all of his powerful speeches and his marches, and he gets a lot of credit. But let me tell you, I have been very critical of black leadership. They never did line up with Jackie in the early years. Mm. He was too radical, and it was too much of a change. It was too uncertain. And you cannot find any place in history where black leadership was in the picture with Jackie Robinson in those early years. And they just said it's too chancy. I mean, for some reason, and even today, black leadership says, yes, Jackie was great. Jackie was a first-time black player. Jackie was a Hall of Famer. But they do not give Jackie due credit for the momentum that he started in causing people to change how the culture actually used to be and say, look, that was wrong. Our Constitution, as Jackie testified in Congress, he said, I'm not mad at anybody. I want you to live up to what our Constitution says. Everybody in America as a citizen is equal, and we're not equal. That's what we're after. And so I just am disappointed. The movie is one of the first things 60 years after the fact that Jackie is now lifted up to a status that's more than a Major League Hall of Famer. He did more for America in some ways than any other civil rights leader.
I would encourage anyone who has not seen the movie to go see it. Also, go to YouTube and see the Jackie Robinson story if you want. It's about probably about an hour and 15 minutes, and it's certainly, as Mr. Erskine said, a build-up and probably a low-budget movie, but it does give some insight into Jackie Robinson. But nothing like what the movie 42 gives, or what we have just gotten in the last hour or so from you, and we're grateful for that. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the book Parallel and how that fits in with Jackie Robinson and your son Jimmy. I think that's a great part of the story, both of you as well as Jackie Robinson.
Well, you know, I've had one lifetime, and my lifetime has had a variety of twists and turns and exciting things and challenges. But I played 9 seasons with Jackie, and we became very close friends. We did a lot of things off the field, and I knew Rachel quite well. And Betty, my wife, and Rachel were good friends. Still are. Rachel still lives. She's in her early 90s, a gracious lady, a beautiful lady, well-educated, polished, high-class lady. And so I watched Jackie and his family endure these indignities of not being accepted. And yet, Jackie's persistence, Mr. Rickey's guidance, history has played out to see that what he was doing, and one of the reasons Jackie was successful is what he was doing was right. Right will always overtake wrong in the end. And Jackie's efforts, while he didn't get to see it all, and he was disappointed that he didn't get to see more happen in his lifetime, his momentum is still here. Believe me, his momentum has caused people to see each other in a different light. And so I salute that, because being his teammate, it was far more than just Jackie helping me pitch. He saved one no-hitter for me with a play against Willie Mays. And all those things are history. But did anything really matter besides just the headlines? Yes. What Jackie did changed America. And I watched this happen, and I saw the impact that Jackie had then. And then you ask about the parallel. My son Jimmy was born in 1960. He was my third son. And when the hospital in my hometown, the whispers went like wildfire. The whispers said the Erskine baby is mongoloid. Now, that's a harsh term. Mm-hmm. It was a harsh time for people who were born into this world who were different, and not by the color of their skin, but by the makeup of their genetic makeup in being different. They were handicapped in some way. They were less than what we say is normal. There were no services. Then the best advice my sweet wife Betty got was, put Jimmy in an institution and he'll be well cared for and you won't disrupt your family. That was the best advice, because there was no place to refer services. Now what we call Down syndrome is the medical term for this awful word that was used when Jimmy was born. So we have come a huge distance in acceptance also in Jimmy's life and people like Jimmy. Now we have special education, we have Special Olympics, which is, again, this field of sport, like Jackie, got to demonstrate he belonged. Special Olympics takes people with special needs, takes them out of the stands where they've always been spectators, put them in the game, let them perform, and what happened? Society has a second time been enriched by including people who are different. And now, Jimmy, my son, he used to be sneered at, looked at, laughed at. He looks different. But time has passed. We've learned a lot. We've changed. And Jackie's momentum, believe me, I think when Jimmy gets a gold medal in Special Olympics, I think my buddy Jackie Robinson had something to do with that. Mm. Because it set the tone for people to begin to look differently at people who they used to reject. And people that we thought in the old days we could not educate, now they're educating us.
Well, Mr. Erskine, as a parent of a son with Down syndrome, an adult son with Down syndrome, I have to say you're a hero to Special Olympics and to those of us that you and your wife Betty took a risk at the time. I don't know how many families had Down syndrome children and institutionalized them and just stuck them away because they didn't know what to do with them.
Right. And there were very few options.
Well, ours on reads and writes and...
Yeah.
It's because of the...
There was a lady at our church who was a school teacher. Her name was Ethel Buchanan. She was a beautiful lady. She taught in middle school today, junior high school. And I had her in school when I was young. But she had twins, and they attended our church. Her husband was a military man, well-decorated, handsome. They were a handsome couple, and they had twins. The little girl was just beautiful. They brought her to church dressed so beautiful. The little boy was severely handicapped. I don't know his condition, but he was just severely handicapped. But this was well before the years Betty and I had Jimmy. And here would Ethel Buchanan and her husband would come to church, and they would bring their twins. They would be dressed beautifully. They brought those children unashamed. They just entered in like nothing different. Well, when Jimmy was born, I couldn't help but think about Ethel Buchanan and how lovingly she brought her children and treated them the same. And people reflected the same. They saw that this was love in its beautiful form, and that helped Betty and me. But there were no resources, only parent to parent. And you would understand that, Janet, that the greatest support we had in the early years were other parents who had special needs children. Mm-hmm. And so we grouped together and said, what can we do to change this? And so it was a long process.
Well,
I began to see the parallel between Jackie and Jimmy.
There's absolutely.
Absolutely.
It is so clear, and I'm one of the recipients of the good part of what you all blazed a path for us, and it's getting better all the time.
Well, and, Betty and I are not celebrities. We're kids that grew up together in this little town of Anderson, Indiana, a nice little Midwestern community. We had beautiful families, a modest home life, but we were raised in good Christian homes. And Betty and I, we sort of like the old song, doing what comes naturally. We didn't have a game plan that we're going to change the world, or we're going to make an impact, or we didn't do that. We tried to do the natural, normal, loving things with our family and with people who didn't understand in the early years, and not hate them, get mad at them, fight with them. That doesn't get you very far. But in time, people saw and began to understand. And so I see the parallel myself that I lived through two huge social changes. And one of them was, of course, the historic Jackie Robinson story. But the second story is that Eunice Shriver, who was a Kennedy, she saw, because of a sister she had named Rosemary, who the Kennedys didn't expose much, and there was not much about Rosemary, who was in some way a special needs person. I don't know what. But that motivated Eunice Kennedy Shriver to say, let's start a special Olympics for people who are not gifted, who are not well coordinated, who don't have the muscle tone and don't have the hand-eye coordination. Let's give them a chance to play sports. Well, that was an off-the-wall idea, just like Mr. Rickey bringing a black player into an all-white society. And so Eunice Shriver is the hero who said, let's do it. And I happen to be one of the people in pro sports that she picked to be one of the coaches to talk about Special Olympics and to promote the idea that people with special needs should have a chance to excel in sports as well. And so that piece of history, so I used to go to events for Mrs. Shriver, and one time I had a World Series ring on, and I had in my pocket I had a medal, and I had told a quick story that we won this World Series ring, and boy, what a team we had, and we should have won it. We were all exceptional in our talents, and a lot of Hall of Famers, a lot of superstars on that team. We should have won. But then I pulled a medal out of my pocket that Jimmy had won in swim meet in Special Olympics. And I said, look at this medal. Now, let me tell you, do you think that this achievement is better or less than this World Series ring? These people who won these medals in gold in Special Olympics, they're not gifted. They don't have all the assets to be a great athlete. But they have the will to try and to get the most out of what they've been given. And that medal, to me, is a better achievement than this World Series ring. Well, hey, Mrs. Shriver, she has flipped out. She said, you got to tell that story. You got to tell that story.
Yeah.
So I went all over the country with Mrs. Shriver promoting Special Olympics.
Well, I have to tell you this: our son, when he was 9 when he was on. Of course, there's a Down syndrome child tends to be smaller than his peers of the same age, and when he was 9, I guess he was on a T-ball team, and he played for 2 years in a row. And the coaches came to us about the first half of the second season that he was playing on this little T-ball league, and they said, you know what, he's really better than all the other T-ball players. Do you mind just bumping him on up to the next league?
Look at that.
So, and he played, he was competitive and he was one of the better players, and they didn't make a whole lot of special concessions for him. And he was competitive for a couple of years in a little league team. And it was great. It was great to see. And had he been born in the 1940s, he wouldn't have been playing baseball.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we see so many contrasts with Jimmy. And there is a league now in special in Little League called the Challenger League. I don't know if you have that league anywhere in your part of the country, but Challenger League is for special needs kids at the Little League level. And so they play in wheelchairs even. And so we've given opportunity to a lot of people who never had a chance. And we've all been enriched by it. I always say when a volunteer hangs a gold medal or a medal around the neck of an athlete, a special athlete, at one of the Special Olympic meets, I wonder who gets the biggest charge, the kid that's getting the medal or the volunteer that's putting it around his neck.
Yeah,
I think it's a toss-up.
Well, you know, the Word says that whatever it is you do, do it with all your might for the glory of God. And it doesn't say do it with all your might for the glory of God if your skin is the right color or if you have the right physical abilities, if you can play this really well. Or it just says do what you can with all your might for the glory of God. And I think that's what Parallel is about. I think that when we look at the Jackie Robinson story and we look at how special needs children now are, how special needs kids are allowed to participate in things that they never were.
Right. Well, it's enriched our society. Let's face it, we're all better off. And Jimmy works at Applebee's restaurant. Now, he fixes tables before they open in the mornings. He does condiments on the tables and so on. And he's been there 14 years. Now, let me tell you, I could have never dreamed that. It would have been too much of a fantasy. When he was born and his IQ was so low and his projection of what he could do was zero. And now Jimmy, he's out there in the real world. He brings home a paycheck. And I said to the manager one day when they had some layoffs at Applebee's in Anderson, I said, boy, Jimmy survived. And he said, and still working. He said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, don't worry about Jimmy. He said, I tell my other employees, watch Jimmy Erskine. Now, he doesn't have a cell phone. He doesn't have a cell phone. He doesn't tell jokes. He doesn't smoke. All he does is clock in and go to work. And you just watch Jimmy.
You know, I have my brother and my sister and I were raised with my aunt, who always lived with us when we were kids, and she was Down syndrome, lived to be about 60-something years old, which was very different in those days. They did not think that they would normally live that long. But I saw my father, when he married my mother, he knew that he was marrying, taking in this aunt of my mother's, and she lived with us for our entire life at home. And my father treated her as though she was an equal child, part of the family. And it gave me a great respect for him and my mother. And it also gave me a real appreciation and love for people that are afflicted with that syndrome. And I don't have exactly the experience that both you and Janet do, but certainly having lived with Margie, was her name, for all those years, I know something about that.
Well, I'll tell you something. I hardly ever go to any kind of a meeting, a program, speak at some group or something. Almost without exception, people come up and they say, you know, I had a neighbor, I have a nephew, I have a brother. I mean, almost every family is touched in some way by a special needs person. Mm-hmm. And what's beautiful about it is the Bible is clear. We're all made in our own way. We're not a copy of anybody, and we're supposed to get the most out of what we've been given. That's the yardstick. That's,
exactly.
The true yardstick in life. And when you see a Special Olympics meet and the last runner is 3 minutes behind the field in a 50-meter dash, and when that runner finally hits the end line, that runner gets the biggest hand.
That's right.
Because there is a recognition that this person is given everything they've got. It's not against the clock or the best runner in the race. It's against what have you been given, how much of it are you getting out of life. And if that's not the truest, most biblical form of measurement to any of us, I think you got to put that at number one.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well said. That, you know, my husband and I often laugh, and sometimes our son Jordan has particular, very particular ways that he likes to do things, and it's a little OCD. But we always wonder if when we get to heaven, is he going to be normal, and we're going to find out how handicapped we were.
Oh, I can't wait. I look in Jimmy's eyes, and I look deep. I see deep into his eyes, and there's a real solid person in there. There's mm-hmm. a loving person in there. And I say to Jimmy, to myself, I'll see you whole one day. And I wonder myself, what does whole mean? Mm-hmm. I think it's in the perception that we have of each other. And it's just, I'm not an author. I wrote my little story. You can read it easy. No big words to look up. And
that's good for me.
but it's a true experience of having lived through two huge cultural changes in society. And I feel that I have been doubly blessed to have been part of both of those. And so it gives me a very thankful morning when I get up. I just, the first words out of my mouth are Thanksgiving.
Wow. We have been more than doubly blessed by having you today and having you to stay as a guest on a second part. This has been enlightening and entertaining and uplifting. And I appreciate so very much your time and your willingness to come and speak with us. We don't know each other from a load of coal, but here you are. And I thank you so much for your gracious attitude, for your honesty, and for your willingness to share.
Absolutely. You've given us over an hour and a half, and we're certainly not great writers or speakers from the standpoint of the world, but we have a show that I think will reach a lot of people. Your message will reach a lot of people. We'll put the name of this book and how people who hear this show can get that book. And we're grateful, thankful, blessed by your presence with us today. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, well, it's been an honor, and someday we'll meet, and face-to-face, we'll be able to shake hands and give each other a hug.
God
bless.
That
sounds good, my brother.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful afternoon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
There you have it, folks. Come and join us again. You never know who you're going to hear on Just Talking It Up. Crash, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so very much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Great time.